court is ready to hear from relator and ex parte chambers.
In the court, Mr. Robert Fish, Mr. Mayor, and the reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
In the court, my name is Robert Frisch. I'm an attorney in Dallas. I've been involved in these proceedings from all through the trial court. I'd like to give just a brief history of the state of the facts of what's happened in this case. This originally involved a man named Frank Chambers, who worked for a local Austin company, International Business Exchange Corporation, as an independent contractor, as a business broker. And the case arose out of Mr. Chambers terminating his arrangements with IBEC, they called in the written submissions, and going into business and competition. There were suits filed by IBEC against Mr. Chambers and his company and two other people who were former employees of IBEC. Mr. Chambers was never an employee of IBEC. He was an independent contractor only. He had no non-compete agreement that was ever enforceable against him. So you're going to hear some statements about how a bad guy that he is, stealing leads, stealing proprietary information. All that was disputed in the lawsuit. None of that was ever admitted. None of that was ever found by the court. And ultimately, this case was settled. That's one problem. You're dealing with a case that's settled, but yet we still had a contempt that had arisen out of that case, which continued on and is now before you. The problem we had in the contempt action, there were two of them. Originally, a contempt was brought for violation of a temporary injunction. Mr. Chambers, Mr. Miller, Mr. Royster, the individuals involved, as well as the company, were all found guilty of contacts with some people who were on this protected list. Fines were levied, fines were paid. So the attempts to categorize Mr. Chambers and his company as scoff laws and flagrant violators of court orders just isn't true. We complied with court orders up through the time that the second contempt was filed. And basically, the second contempt, there was never any proof that Mr. Chambers ever violated a court order. They couldn't prove that he personally did. And as a result, the only thing that was found was the corporation was found to be in contempt in order to pay a fine.
Do you contend this is imprisonment for debt?
Yes, sir, I sure do.
And did you preserve that issue? Is that before us?
I believe it is in my points of error. And that goes to whether this is a civil or criminal penalty in nature. The type of penalty that was given in this case, Mr. Chambers was ordered to pay a $6,000, initially a $3,000 fine. The corporation was ordered to pay, but Mr. Chambers was ordered to pay a $6,000 fine, which was double that amount, and then ordered to jail for 7 days, and thereafter so long as he didn't pay the fine. So our contention is that he has to, that is an improper order, because he's not being allowed to expunge the jail time merely by paying the fine. He still has to serve 7 days regardless, and we feel that that's an improper order. It's an unlawful order. We believe that the fine that was levied in this case of $3,000 against the corporation, we proved at the time of the hearing on the contempt action, Mr. Chambers was served with notice to show cause why he personally should not be held in contempt for causing the corporation to pay the fine. Mr. Chambers was never ordered to pay the fine personally. Yet in the hearing, we put on proof that the corporation ceased doing business in March of 1993, that in June of 93, when this case was heard, the corporation was not in business, the corporation had no assets, had no receivables, had no money with which to pay the fine. excuse me, been fighting the cold. Mr. Chambers had personally been involved in bankruptcy, filed in October 92, was discharged, finally completed in March of 93.
This was a personal bankruptcy?
Personal bankruptcy, yes, sir. That's correct. And he was discharged of all claims, causes of action. No objection to his discharge by IBEC. He went through that clean as a whistle. So
how do you distinguish the federal cases that seem to be getting cited where the order was against the corporation failed to comply with the order, and officers are then sanctioned because of their control to do that? Feds seem to have no difficulty doing this. Why do you think we ought to do something different?
The reason I think you ought to do something different is because exactly what this very court has ruled in two cases I cited in my brief, in Hodges and Stoner, and the Court of Appeals tried to make distinctions, and my opponents tried to make distinctions, but the clear language that this court has read is that if the court order itself fails to spell out the details of compliance in clear, specific, and unambiguous terms, number one, as to the acts to be performed, and number two, as to the party to perform them, then the order will not support a contempt.
If the order had commanded Mr. Chambers to personally perform an act or desist from performing some act, would it then be subject to enforcement by contempt?
Yes, sir. It sure would. And I agree with that 100%. And that's exactly what should have been done here. Mr. Chambers, if the court had desired to subject him personally, should have ordered him to cause the corporation to pay the fine, should have ordered him to pay the fine if the corporation couldn't. At the June 93 hearing, he was not found to be in contempt of anything. He was not ordered to do one thing with regard to the fine of $3,000. And that's where the problem is. And this court has said, and that I've read McCallum, which sets out the guidelines and standards for what must be in a contempt order for it to be enforceable. I've read Hodges. I've read Stoner. And these cases all say that in the state of Texas, a court order to be sufficient to support the contempt has to spell out in clear and unequivocal terms, number one, not only the acts to be performed, but also the party to perform them. And that's the distinction. Those federal cases, they also didn't direct the individual to perform. But in Texas, we have these cases where, and incidentally, none of those federal cases were arising out of the Texas court. Those all arose, there's not one case cited in the Appellee's brief, IBEC's briefs, that cites a Texas case for the proposition that they're trying to support. I understand what the federal courts have said, but the rulings that we have in Texas so far issued by this court on this issue are that not only the acts, but the person to perform them have to be spelled out in the order. And that's the distinction. Now, there's a big issue in this case about whether Mr. Chambers, at least being raised by IBEC, Mr. Chambers ought to be liable because this corporation was a sham, it's an alter ego, he shut down IBS and went into business as a sole proprietor. Well, he did that, number one, because he had just gone through bankruptcy, had cleaned up his record completely vis-a-vis this litigation and every other debt, so he didn't have the baggage of this lawsuit hanging on him personally, other than the fact that he was still under an ongoing injunction not to contact their former customers.
He just opened shop, same place, same address, same phone number, just different name, different label.
He did, that's true, but we didn't violate any laws in doing that. That doesn't violate a law one. We shut down that corporation. It ceased doing business. There was never a time that the sole proprietorship and the corporation were doing business at the same time. And we started doing it under a different name. We started doing it using different materials and somewhat different activities, too. And that was testified by Mr. Chambers. So at the time this hearing was held in June, this corporation didn't exist. There was never a pleading by IBEC of alter ego. There was never a pleading of sham corporation. So their attempts to rely on the Canterbury decision in here, just that was off the wall, because there's never a pleading, never a finding, never an allegation, never proof that that ever happened until we got into the Court of Appeals on this appeal. So there's nothing to support that. Trial court in 368, Judge Carnes or Judge Morgan never found that there was an alter ego or a sham. So there can't, that's an issue that's really not before this court.
What about the funds that were withdrawn from one account, or the allegation that funds in one account all of a sudden disappeared?
Judge, that was $290. That's all that were there in the month of June of 93. In March of 93, Mr. Chambers testified, and his testimony is in the exhibits that you have, that there was approximately $11,000 in March when the corporation was shutting down. He was under no court orders at that time to do anything with that money. He went ahead and paid the bills as far as they would go, and went ahead and depleted the account by paying normal operating expenses. He didn't take one dime of money himself. He hadn't received a paycheck. That was his testimony. He hadn't received the, he testified he hadn't even bought himself a new pair of shoes in 2 years out of the money from this corporation.
Was that evidence in dispute?
Oh, man, no, sir, it was not. There was never any dispute of it. So their contention that he, quote, withdrew all the money, it was a whole total of $290 that was withdrawn in June of 94, shortly before the hearing on this case. In March, the contempt order hadn't been filed. The motion for contempt hadn't been filed.
Well, my question is, you're saying that IBEC did not at the time of the hearing, and does not now contest where that $11,000 went?
That's true. Absolutely correct. So the alter ego and the sham theory, that just, in my opinion, just absolutely doesn't apply.
That was not raised until the Court of Appeals.
I'm sorry?
The whole issue of alter ego and sham was not raised until the Court of Appeals?
Absolutely correct. There was never a pleading of that and no proof of it, never an allegation of that in the trial court in the 368. Now, Ms. IBEC would say that officers are liable for corporate wrongdoing if they participate in wrongdoing. Well, there's been no wrongdoing here. That's the whole issue on that. What's the wrongdoing? There was evidence, all the evidence presented at the hearing in October of 93 was to the effect that since March of 93, the corporation had no assets and had no ability to raise assets, had no ability to raise money. Mr. Chambers had been through bankruptcy personally. How in the world the corporation couldn't have gone out and obtained the $3,000 to pay that fine. All that evidence was presented. So what's the wrongdoing? That Mr. Chambers went in and opened up a business as a sole proprietor instead of continuing to operate as a corporation subject to this litigation, subject to the claim of another creditor, a secured creditor, had a security UCC-1 on all the assets, who was suing him at that time to foreclose on the note and on their security agreement. It made absolutely no sense to me as an attorney representing my client to advise him to continue to operate that corporation just for the benefit of trying to preserve it for this lawsuit. So there were all kinds of reasons to justify shutting that corporation down. And Mr. Chambers, again, had been discharged in bankruptcy. He was free of this litigation, and he had the right to go on and do business as a sole proprietor free of that baggage. That's exactly what I advised him to do, and I'd stand beside that advice I gave him today.
The contempt fine was not discharged.
No, sir. There was no contempt finding at the time. The discharge occurred in March of 91. The contempt finding was not until October of 93. '93, Your Honor. His discharge was March of 93. The contempt finding was October of 93.
Any other questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
My question before you begin, Chambers was subject to the temporary injunction.
Yes, ma'am.
And he was a party to the lawsuit.
Yes, ma'am.
Defendant in the lawsuit.
Yes, ma'am.
But at the first hearing, when the corporation was filed, was found in contempt and fined $3,000. He was not in contempt at that time. Is that correct?
That June 24th order did not find Frank Chambers personally in contempt. That's right. However, that was not the first contempt before the court.
I understand. But at that hearing, there was no evidence, or apparently the judge did not find that he was in contempt of the temporary injunction.
That's correct. The court in the June 24th contempt order found IBS, the corporation, in contempt, and not Frank Chambers personally.
Was there any effort to find him in contempt?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. And the court, for its reasons, determined that it would impose a contempt finding on the corporation only. There's no dispute today. We're not trying to allege that the contempt order at issue was directed at Frank Chambers personally. The sole issue before this court is whether Frank Chambers personally can be found in contempt for violation of an order directed to IBF, to the corporation, given the relationship between Frank Chambers and the corporation.
So you concede that the judgment did not order him personally to perform any act or desist from performing any act?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It ordered IBS to perform a certain act, pay $3,000 by this date. And for three reasons, Frank Chambers personally ought to be held in contempt for that not happening. First, under the huge body of federal cases that are cited in our brief, and there are some supplemental cases, I believe, that have been distributed on the bench. Not only federal cases, but courts in other states have found that officers and directors who are directly responsible for the day-to-day operations of a corporation ought to be held liable, held in contempt for the failure to make that happen. The U.S. Supreme Court, I think, gave a perfect explanation of why you ought to do that. Command to a corporation is in effect a command to those who are officially responsible for the conduct of its affairs. If they, apprised of the writ directed to the corporation, prevent compliance or fail to take appropriate action within their power for the performance of the corporate duty, they, no less than the corporation itself, are guilty of disobedience and may be punished for contempt.
Filed these cases rather than allege alter ego?
Now, Your Honor, that's one thing I'd like to clear up. I think there's a packet of that constitutes the record in this case. And item number 12 in the packet that this court has is excerpt from the statement of fact at the first contempt hearing of this on this order. And on page 71 of the statement of fact, the court will find a citation to this court's opinion in the Castleberry case, and a lengthy discussion of the theory of alter ego. So the allegation that we didn't raise it before the trial court is just not so, and the court will find that on page 71 of item 12 in the record excerpt.
The trial court judgment does not mention the alter ego theory.
It does not use that term, alter ego, Justice Cornyn. The court discusses the fact that Frank Chambers was the sole officer, director, and 100% shareholder, and discusses the fact that he was responsible for the day-to-day operations of the corporation. It does not make that specific finding of alter ego.
Do you agree with your opposing counsel that the issue of whether this constitutes imprisonment for debt in violation of the Texas Constitution is preserved for our review?
I don't believe it's preserved. I don't think that you'll find imprisonment for debt enumerated among Mr. Frisch's points of errors. However, if this court somehow finds it implied among those points of error, I don't think that that's an issue here. The contempt order of the trial court did essentially three things. It imposed a $6,000 debt fine. It ordered Frank Chambers in prison for 7 days, and it ordered him in prison thereafter until he paid his fine. So three separate things. The first two, the fine and the 7 days, are penalties. They are criminal contempt. They are unconditional. He can't get out of those by complying now. The third item, the imprisonment thereafter until he pays the fine, I believe that's what Mr. Frisch is trying to allege is imprisonment for debt. But in fact, it's not. That's straight up, regular Joe, plain vanilla civil contempt. They're trying to make him pay the fine. He has the keys to the jailhouse in his pocket. He pays his fine. He walks.
Let me ask you, Ms. Weber, what is the, I mean, I see these other cases, but it seems to me Texas has a long line of cases that say you're not going to put somebody in jail unless they are specifically ordered to do something and apprised of what it is they need to do to avoid that danger. What is the policy? What balances in favor of this kind of, we haven't ordered Mr. Chambers to do anything, but he should have known since he was the boss that he could be thrown in jail if his corporation didn't comply. How does that measure up to a simple proceeding where IBEC comes forward and says the corporation hasn't paid, we want an order against the officers or directors directing them to pay this fine? What says that Texas, under its strong view of contempt, saying that that is not a step that you ought to go through in order to make sure that Chambers knew that he was at risk of going to jail if he didn't direct that the corporation do this thing?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons that this court ought to find Frank Chambers personally in contempt. First, the rationale that's applied in all of the federal cases is equally applicable here. What makes a corporation do what it's supposed to do? It's officers. It's individuals. The corporation cannot act except through its component parts. And in this case, there's only one. In this case, there is absolutely no distinction between the corporation and Frank Chambers. When it was no longer convenient to have that corporation wad it up in a ball and throw it out, there was no formal winding up. There was no formal transfer of assets. Frank Chambers took those assets, the office, the phones, the receivables, the everything, and shifted it over to his own use. So there isn't a question of some anonymous officer or director somewhere. This is the sole man. He's the only person who could make it happen. And I think it's a pragmatic rule that the U.S. Supreme Court came up with, that if the person in charge of the day-to-day operation doesn't do it, who else is going to be able to do it? Now, as far as what makes Texas different from these federal courts elsewhere, I think you're right that Texas has a strong policy towards making contempt orders just as clear as they possibly can be. And I think if you look at the underlying order to the corporation, positively the only place that there might be ambiguity is in whether the individual be held liable for an order to the corporation. There's no question about time or about the act to be done or anything else.
His name isn't mentioned.
His name's not mentioned there. The only question is, does IBS mean an order to Frank Chambers? Now, if you look at this court's opinion in the Ex parte Hodges case, that's one of the cases, one of the two Texas cases, where the court struck down a contempt finding because it was based on an order that was not clear. I think the standard that the court recited is that the order must be clear, specific, and unambiguous. Now, in the Ex parte Hodges case, the trial court hadn't issued an order, but had appointed a receiver and made declarations of the powers of the receiver. The receiver then issued an order based on that declaration. And the trial court, the order that the receiver made was directed to a corporation to turn over its books. The trial court imposed contempt upon an officer of the corporation for violating the receiver's order. This court struck down that contempt order because the trial court's order had been a declaration and not an order. This court did not say it was improper to have found the officer individually in contempt. This court said only if there has to have been an order to do some action. Now, if there were also the default, if there were also the problem of the officer not appropriately being held in contempt, then don't you think that this court would have said so at that time and clarified that it must be an affirmative order and it must also not take an officer in where the corporation was addressed only?
Ms. Wimmer, if we accept, if we allowed Texas to follow the federal rules on this and a corporation is involved in litigation and there's a notice to take deposition of someone working for the corporation, and that person fails to appear, and you bring a notice of contempt against the corporation for failing to produce that witness, and the court orders the corporation to produce that witness at the hearing, would this rule permit any supervisor of that witness to be jailed on a show cause for having failed to produce that witness?
Your Honor, I think, first of all, that's exactly the scenario that was presented to the United States Supreme Court in U.S. versus Wilson. It was a subpoena duces tecum, and the corporation failed to comply with the subpoena duces tecum, and the Supreme Court found the president of that corporation in contempt for the corporation's failure to comply with the subpoena duces tecum.
Could they have found the custodian of the records in contempt for having failed to comply?
I think the standard is who is responsible for that action happening. Who is responsible for the day-to-day activities of the corporation in making that happen? In this case, there's no such leak. If there were some officer somewhere who happened to, for instance, in the contempt motion where Mr. Chambers was found in contempt, we had also sought contempt against other officers and directors of record. And the trial court said no, they're not appropriately held in contempt because they didn't have a role. They weren't responsible for the day-to-day activities of IBS. So I think that there's a level of protection built in. It's not just a willy-nilly drag in anyone who's an officer and director. It's
shouldn't
who can make this happen.
But shouldn't the determination of who the responsible party for requiring the corporation to do that occur at a time that that responsible party is not faced with jail? Shouldn't the determination of who's the responsible party to make the corporation comply occur at a time when that person is then, having lost that, knowing I am therefore directed to comply with this order subject to contempt for failure to do so? Shouldn't all those determinations of who the responsible party is, the one who's going to be liable for the sanction, occur not in the show cause hearing itself, but in fact at a order directing them to respond?
Well, I think that model that you proposed would have the effect of building in another layer of a safety net. However, I think that's not necessary to protect the due process and other concerns of the potential contemnor. And also, I don't think it's a workable model. I think you would have a hearing to determine the scope of the order that came out of a hearing before you have a hearing to determine if the order from the first one had been violated. At the show cause hearing, where contempt can be imposed, if an officer was not in fact in a position to make the order be complied with and have the corporation do what it's supposed to do, then the contemnor has that opportunity, can prove it's not my division, I couldn't have done it, here's this impossibility. There is an opportunity. Frank Chambers had an opportunity to establish that he couldn't make it happen. And in the two hearings that resulted in this contempt, he was not able to meet that burden because he, in fact, was the one who could make it happen.
If I understand the sequence and the factual circumstances of his underlying contempt correctly, I want to be sure about it. February of 93, the trial court found IBS and Chambers in contempt. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And at that time, ordered temporary injunction, TRO, temporary injunction, fined them collectively $1,500.
Yes, sir.
Chambers and his corporation. second contempt was in June of 93, but it was only against the corporation. Is that correct? Found that IBS had again violated the TRO temporary injunction and fined IBS $3,000. IBS subsequently went out of existence.
That's the million dollar question, Justice Gammons. There was a lot of testimony.
Is there any significance to the fact that the trial court at the second contempt hearing and its second contempt order did not address it, specifically did not address it to Chambers personally, but only against the corporation, whereas the initial order, initial contempt, was against both. The second was only against the corporation, and now you're attempting a third proceeding to enforce that second contempt order against him personally, when the trial court specifically declined to impose it against him personally at the second hearing. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. And I'm not going to lie to you. We tried to get contempt against Frank Chambers personally in the June 24th hearing, and the trial court declined to do so and imposed it against IBS. The contempt against Frank Chambers that came out of the October hearing and its order, and then the subsequent clarification in the November hearing and that's order, that contempt is not against Frank Chambers individually for the acts that led up to the June 24th IBS contempt. That is Frank Chambers in his capacity as officer, director, sole shareholder, running the operations of IBS.
I understand that, but what seems to me that the major obstacle that you have to overcome is that you attempted to have him specifically held in contempt in that second hearing. The trial court specifically declined to do that. And the trial court specifically declined to do that, not in the face of federal precedent and not in the face of precedent from other jurisdictions, but in the context of Texas law and history.
Well, actually, the court declined to do that not with reference to any law of any jurisdiction, but based on the facts. The facts were that there was no question that someone on behalf of the corporation had violated the court's numerous injunctions and restraining orders that were in place. There was no question that someone had done it. The question was identifying who was on the phone. Whoever called on behalf, made all of these contacts on behalf of IBS, used a false name, Tom Harley, made a number of phone calls saying, "I am Tom Harley," and violating the court's injunction. Because we were not able to identify who Tom Harley was to the satisfaction of the trial court imposed contempt directly on the corporation.
Your argument is that regardless of the fact that the trial court directed the contempt order exclusively at the corporation, not against Chambers personally, since Chambers is the only personality that the corporation ever consisted of and is the officer charged with fulfilling corporate responsibilities, he should be held personally liable.
Yes, sir.
Third pursuit.
Absolutely. That's exactly it. And now I'd like to turn to a couple.
Let me ask one more question along this line. There in these latter contempt proceedings, when the criminal was imposed, there's no question about who the criminal contempt affected. It wasn't the corporation, it was the shared person, wasn't it?
Yes, sir. And he was the subject of that show cause hearing.
At that time, did he plead his bankruptcy?
Your Honor, I don't believe that bankruptcy would have an effect on whether or not he could be held in contempt, either civilly or criminally. I think that
The criminal was applied not just to his actions, but the fact that he hadn't paid the fine.
Well, Mr. Chambers attempted to establish inability to pay at the show cause hearing.
At the third and fourth proceedings.
Yes, sir. He attempted to show that. And there was some evidence. He did introduce some evidence. However, he did not introduce all the evidence that Mr. Frisch represented to you. I think if you scour the record, you're not going to find any mention of Mr. Chambers not getting a paycheck from IBS 1 or IBS 2. You're not going to find any mention of he couldn't buy himself any new shoes. There were three items Mr. Chambers testified to. Question and answer. I don't have any money in the bank, I have no receivables, I have no assets I can liquidate. On cross-examination, Mr. Chambers admitted that there was the 11 grand in the bank that he'd emptied, that he'd been paying weekly to send mass mailings, he was still paying his lawyer, and in any event, the three-prong test for proving inability to pay includes a requirement that you establish that you unsuccessfully attempted to borrow a sum from financial institutions and that you know of no other source, including relatives from whom you might borrow, and there was no evidence as to either of those points. I see my time has expired. If the court has any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I just have one. The show cause order mentions the names of Alan Noah Miller and Donna Nichols as says that they're officers of the corporation. Is that true? Officers and directors of International Business Search, Inc.?
They were listed on the articles of incorporation. However, the testimony at trial established that they were there in name only. They had no ongoing role in the corporation, and that's why the trial court found they had no responsibility for the day-to-day actions. They couldn't make the compliance happen. Therefore, they would not be subject to contempt.
Even though the two people that were omitted, Alan Noah Miller and Donna Nichols, could they have outvoted Mr. Chambers?
Well, the testimony at trial established that they had no real role. They were, in effect, officers and directors on paper only for purposes of...
De facto, or they had no real...
They had no real role. They had no real power to come forward and do anything. In fact, I believe that the testimony established that Donna Wilson, in fact, had never had any role at all, was only placed there because you needed a name.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counselor.
Justice Hightower, I'd like to address the question you raised. Mr. Chambers never had a day in court personally to show, subject to a show cause, directed him to show cause why he personally couldn't pay that fine. The show cause was directed to him to show cause why the corporation didn't pay the fine. The way I interpreted that and the way we presented the evidence was that the evidence had to show and satisfy the test that the corporation did not have the assets, the corporation did not have the ability to pay the fine. And that's the evidence I presented. Had I known that Mr. Chambers was going to be called upon personally to pay it, I sure would have put in proof that he did not have the ability to do so. He had just gotten out of bankruptcy and had no assets, and I could have easily proved that had the show cause told me that was my burden.
Really,
we've never had a day in court on that
issue. I really
issue.
Don't understand how a corporation can be in criminal contempt, though, without being aware of the fact that that criminal penalty is going to apply to some person.
Well, but who? Where do you draw the line? There was never, in spite of what has been said, there's never been a finding by the court that the corporate existence didn't exist, that it was a sham or an alter ego. Therefore, you have a separate corporate entity that still has to stand on its own and exist. So
there's no question that Mr. Chambers was in control.
No question.
As opposed to anybody else.
No question.
You had control of the $11,000 the other side discussed, the amount that was used to do mailings, the amount that was used to pay you. Who had control? Who was signing those checks on that $11,000? And in what capacity were they signing those checks?
Mr. Chambers, and as president of the company.
With his company or his corporation? Or
as the corporation, yes.
This is the corporation did have the assets in the bank.
Well, but they didn't. They had those in March of 93, in the 1st of March of 93. They didn't have them in June. In June, there was $209. The corporation shut down in March.
What about the corporate assets?
The only corporate assets there were some office equipment, materials, furniture, fixtures, and all those were subject to a lien by a secured creditor. A creditor filed suit, got a judgment, foreclosed those assets, and ultimately worked out a deal with Chambers to lease them back, but that was a lawsuit where the assets were actually taken back by the secured creditor. So for her to sit here and say Mr. Chambers just started, sure, he used them, but he used them after he made a deal with the secured creditor in his individual capacity because she convinced him that he had gone through bankruptcy and wasn't going to be subject to losing it and all
that.
That's
all his record.
Yes, sir, it was, I believe.
So long as an individual can manipulate the legal technicalities, they can never be held personally responsible for their actions. Is that right?
No, sir, and I don't contend that. But what I contend, and this goes back to the question the judge, Justice Enoch, was asking, had we been ordered, had Judge Carnes seen fit in June to issue an order that says the corporation is held in contempt and Mr. Chambers shall cause the corporation to pay that fine, I would have no problem with it. Judge Carnes did not see fit to do that. As was pointed out, Mr. Chambers was the subject of that contempt proceeding. He was not found to be in contempt, and now they're still trying to get him for that same contempt by coming in the back door when Judge Carnes already didn't failed to find him responsible for that contempt. The order, now this, my opponent said in here that I didn't know the law of the state of Texas. I gave poor legal advice. Well, I must have because we're here today. But there's no reported Texas case on point. This court should at least tell us as lawyers so we can advise our clients if, in fact, corporate officers are going to be held responsible in such capacities. I go back to Hodge and Talon.
Your time has expired, Counsel. All right. So if there's a question, Your Honor. Thank you, Counsel. That concludes the argument and the foregoing clauses. Both will be submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
Oye, 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 o